Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, and today is October 7th. Now, as most of you probably already know, October 7th is, of course, my birthday. But unfortunately, I share that birthday with one of our biggest foes. Of course, I'm talking about Vladimir Putin and, the United States. First responded in Afghanistan on October 7th. And then, of course, it's been a year ago that we had the attack on Israel on October 7th. So I'm not sure it's a great day to have a birthday, but it's something, you know, this Israel war has been going on a year. And I thought we would ask Bob Peters. You know, Bob's a fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he's a friend of mine, and Bob's been doing a lot of work, and he thinks a lot about deterrence, and he's been thinking a lot about the war in Israel. And so we thought, given that it's the anniversary, we would have Bob come talk about it. So Bob, thanks for coming on NucleCast.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Great to be here.
Of course, you know, it's a solemn day to remember the attack and the lives lost. And, you know, this has been the Israeli response has been one that I don't think many people expected to be this persistent and this long over time, because there sort of was a cycle to this. You know, in the year since the attack, I've been reading quite a bit. I spent some time worked in Israel over whenever I was in the military and then subsequently. And so I've sort of been, you know, relearning much about Israel and sort of what's been going on over the last 10 or 15 years. And as I think about it, it was a deterrence failure on the part of Israel towards Hamas. But and then, of course, you know, we've seen what we've seen over the last year, and we've seen what we've seen in the U.S. As you think about the war in Israel, how are you thinking about it? How are you looking at it? You know, how do you see sort of, you know, there's this, you know, it's a, you know, it was Israel Hamas. Now it's Israel Hamas, Israel Hezbollah. And then now we've got the Iranians involved. And, you know, there's some concern that this could become like an 8-front war. How are you looking at it, and how are you seeing it, and thinking through what the Israelis should do? How do you deter Iran? All of these kinds of things.
Yeah. So, you know, what I'll say is I have been thinking about this quite a bit, in part just as a national security professional looking at it through that lens, also looking at the lens of Iran as becoming closer to being a breakout nuclear weapon state. You know, what I'd say is, I think you're right that October 7th was a deterrence failure. And I think that if I were Israeli, I'd be doing the exact same things that they would be doing. And I would be making no apologies for it. I think that, you know, looking at some of the pictures that came out of October 7th of the hostages that they took, and let's not forget that they're still, to this day, 7 American citizens who are being held hostage by Hamas. And we should not forget that. And we should not forget that there are babies and toddlers that have spent at this point the majority of their life being held hostage by Hamas. And in that sense, you telescope out beyond Hamas and you saw how 20% of northern Israel was basically depopulated be out of fear of these rocket attacks from Hezbollah that were coming down. And then you see these massive salvos that Iran's been firing on Israel. And I think that Israel is fighting, as you correctly point out, a multi-front war right now. And it's, I think that, you know, Iran and their proxies of Hamas and Hezbollah have decided that it's time to destroy the state of Israel. And, you know, Israel, as I said, is doing what they deem necessary to defend their state. And I think that they should continue to do so however they see best. And I will say that what they've been doing, unless you've completely gone down the rabbit hole of believing the Gaza Ministry of Health, you know, their wackadoodle numbers of how many Palestinians have been killed by Israel. This has been almost, you know, one of the most antiseptic wars that have been fought. And we can talk about that, of just how precise a number of these Israeli strikes have been, to include the pager explosions and the killing of Nasrallah and so forth. But this is damn near a collateral damage-free conflict as you can possibly imagine. And so, you know, Israel has caught a lot of crap from the quote unquote international humanitarian rights community. I think in some ways the last 12 months have been a clarifying moment for the world, because we actually see who actually cares about human rights and who actually simply poses as doing so as a facade for anti-Westernism and making apologies for the authoritarians. So I know that's a lot there, and I'm happy to go in whatever direction you want.
So as we think about, you know, that I've been thinking a lot, sort of like you have, about Iran and what does Iran do? And, you know, they fought through proxies, or, you know, they're still supporting the Houthis, and the Houthis are attacking, you know, American shipping. They're attacking the Israelis. You know, Hezbollah is a long time proxy, and then Hamas eventually, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so therefore Hamas has gotten support from Iran. But now, you know, now that Iran is actually in it, right? So Iran said, oh man, we can't take the Israelis attacking Hezbollah, and which is, you know, it's a proxy group. It's not Iran proper. And so therefore Iran launches, you know, the second set of attacks on Israel, which, you know, this is clearly war. And I've wondered what has stopped Iran from going nuclear. And some of it, I've thought, you know, I wonder, is Iran not going nuclear out of fear that that will cause, you know, a nuclear strike by the Israelis? Because, you know, I think that would be existential for the Israelis, and therefore they might strike first. They've proven that they will do that. And the Iranians have said, hey, it's not worth the risk. Or is there another reason that they have not gone nuclear? Because they're a latent nuclear power. As you look at it, and we sort of are all stuck guessing, we don't have concrete evidence either way. How do you read that situation and you know, Iranian action?
So the Trump administration pulled out of the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal in May of 2018. According to the IAEA, in May of 2021 is when Iran started stockpiling uranium, you know, and in 2023, Iran expelled one third of the IAEA nuke inspectors from Iran. And then later that year, the IAEA came out and said they found traces of 60% enriched uranium, which is only just a step away from weapons-grade uranium. And in July of 2024, Secretary of State Tony Blinken said that it would only take Iran about 1 to 2 weeks to have enough weapons-grade uranium for a nuclear device. And then in August of 2024, the unclassified ODNI report on Iran's nuclear program left out the sentence that said, we do not assess that Iran is building a nuclear warhead at this time. They left that sentence out, which was different from the February 2024 report that the ODNI released. And so, you know, what's kept Iran from going nuclear? You know, maybe it was the JCPOA in the Obama administration. Maybe it was the fear of Trump and American response during the Trump administration. Because I think that, you know, I think that Iran made the assessment, we're not going to screw around. We may push the Trump administration to a certain degree. And then President Trump ordered the killing of the IRGC commander in towards the end of his administration. And then once President Biden took office, that's when you saw the real lean into enrichments and trying to stockpile enriched uranium to get to a point in which they could assemble a bomb. And I think at this point that both in Israel and also in Iran, they're looking at an American president that, you know, if we're being honest, basically said, I don't have the mental capacity to run for reelection. And they're looking at Washington that is not exhibiting political leadership, which is dangerous for the Middle East. That's really dangerous for the United States. So I think both Tel Aviv and Tehran are saying, we're going to do whatever we deem necessary, and we're not going to worry about what the Americans do or do not say, because at the end of the day, no one is home in the White House to tell us not to. Or if they do, we just don't really give a damn at this point. We're going to do what we deem necessary. And so I actually think that Iran may have made the strategic decision to get a nuclear bomb. Maybe the only thing that's holding them in check is this fear of Israel using some of its capabilities to destroy Iranian targets that may or may not be part of the regime or may not be part of their nuclear program. But I think, you know, Iran doesn't have a lot of other options other than ballistic missiles at this point, because Israel, for all intents and purposes, has, you know, dismantled Hamas and both literally and figuratively largely castrated Hezbollah. And so there's not much left that Iran has in its hole other than ballistic missiles and then potentially its nuclear program.
Yeah. Yeah. I see where you're going. And, you know, it's one of those questions where, you know, we're always left wanting for the, you know, the quality of the answer, because we just sort of have to make our best educated guesses. And I can't help but think that Israel has been, you know, while they may have failed to deter on October 7th, that their responses have been strong enough that they have, in some respects, been reestablishing deterrence against, you know, some of their, you know, potential neutrals who could have potentially supported, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, whatever, or some of their very clear adversaries that, you know, and as Israel has worked pretty hard over the last, you know, we've had the Abraham Accords, we've had Israel work pretty significantly to try to build good relationships with many of the Arab world, you know, the nations of the Arab world. You know, Israel protects Israeli technology protects, you know, Saudi oil fields. There's a lot sort of that's going on under the radar that, you know, the average citizen of across the region doesn't necessarily know is going on. But I wonder, as we think about just the future, what happens a year from now, 6 months from now, how do you see this sort of playing out? You know, what do you see Israel doing? Do you see the West and the United States sort of standing by Israel, or do you see sort of the United States stepping back and saying, well, we have so much, you know, whether it's oil or other relations with the Arab world, so therefore, you know, Israel is an acceptable, you know, sacrificial lamb? Or how do you see this whole situation playing out?
So it's, what's been striking is that the Saudis and the Gulfies, you know, UAE and so forth, have not been condemning Israel. Not really. I mean, I think that what you're seeing is they don't much like Hamas and Hezbollah, and they really don't like Iran. And so I think they kind of look at this and say, well, the Israelis in a lot of ways are doing some of our work for us. And, you know, every missile that Iran fires at Israel is one less missile that could be targeted against Saudi Arabia. And so I think in a lot of ways, the Gulf states are just kind of happy with how things are playing with Israel. I am concerned, and I think Israel actually is the one thing I maybe push against you a bit is I don't think actually Israel is trying to reestablish deterrence with Hezbollah. I actually think that at this point they're trying to dismantle Hezbollah.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Like they dismantled Hamas. Yeah. The question is, what do they do about Iran? And I think that's, I think that is actually the topic of discussion right now in Israel, is what do we do about Iran? Because at the end of the day, they're the ones who are really calling the shots in all these groups. Are they not fundamentally the problem? And so that's their big concern. I think our big question in Washington is, how much material support are we going to give to Israel to do what they deem necessary, both in the sense of missile interceptors, but then also in long range fires, and you know, that's a Washington question. And then the ultimate question is, do you take this as an opportunity to try to roll back their nuclear program? And there's a whole bunch of different, and that's a raging debate right now on Twitter and elsewhere. But it's, you know, do you have the munitions to be able to do that? How much damage could you do? How far would that set them back? Would that actually accelerate their program, or would they slow it down? Can Israel do it as solo, or would the United States have to join them? And those are the questions. And that, but then other people have pointed out correctly, look, if you're going to do it, this is the time, you know, when you've essentially got, you know, Hamas is all but dead. You've got Hezbollah cowering in under a rock someplace, whoever's left standing from Hezbollah. Iran has fired their shots when it comes to ballistic missiles. They don't yet have probably a nuclear capability. If you're going to do it, it ain't going to get better the longer you wait. And so that's the big thing for Israel right now is, what do they do? I am a bit concerned about this huge, people say it's anti-Zionism or decolonialization. We need to be really like honest with ourselves and say, no, it's anti-Semitism. Like all the stuff we're seeing on college campuses and on left-wing city councils, just have the moral clarity to say, no, that's anti-Semitism. That's a longer term problem for Israel is if this view continues to grow and if anti-Semitism continues to become more mainstream, does Israel a generation from now find itself in the place where South Africa was in 1986, which is this kind of like, you know, pariah outcast state. And I would hate to see that happen, but I think unless the narrative changes on college campuses and, you know, like I said, left-wing city councils, that's maybe where we're headed. I don't know.
Well, so we're at that time where we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want you to sort of think about, for Iran, you know, we said, hey, I asked you anyways, and you gave me your response. So I want to pose a second question, and that is, do you think part of the reason that Iran may be holding back on taking that last step to go nuclear is that it's concerned sort of the proliferation spiral, let's say, take the Israelis out, the proliferation spiral that it might set off where, you know, the Saudis already have the delivery systems. They just need the warheads, and the, you know, Pakistan might be the one to give that to them. And then, you know, Turkey might go, Egypt might go. You could set off this sort of regional spiral. And do they worry about that? So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back. This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. And we're back, Bob. I sort of gave you a question before the break. How do you think that could be part of the reason? I'm trying to really understand, why has Iran not gone nuclear?
Yeah, so I personally, like, I think they're going at this point. I think they're going for it. If they have not made that decision, why might they not have made the decision to go? I think it could be out of fear of, like, because there's a window there in which it is, we're not quite a full-on nuclear power, but we've got some initial capabilities that makes you a really inviting target for a first strike. And that's a dangerous valley to be in, you know, as you make that transition to a nuclear power. And I think that's part of it, is how do they navigate that without getting smoked by Israel or the United States or someone else. Are they concerned about proliferation? I don't know. Like, the older I get, maybe I'm just becoming more cynical, but like the older I get, the more I think that concerns about proliferation only exist in the minds of Westerners, you know, and maybe a few Japanese. But other than that, I don't think anybody cares. Like, I don't think that there's like this great taboo against proliferation. It's in our interest not to see a more proliferated world as Americans, but like, I don't think people are like, oh my God, there's a new nuclear weapon state outside of the West. Does Iran fear like Turkey or Egypt or Saudi Arabia could get the bomb? Maybe. But, you know, I think they're living just fine with Pakistan having the bomb and they don't worry much about Pakistan. I understand that's a different relationship with Saudi Arabia. I don't think that like Saudi Arabia would write a big fat check to Pakistan and Pakistan would give them the bomb. There's a lot of reasons why I don't think that would happen. I don't think Egypt could pull it off. Like, I think Egypt's structural problems are such that they could not actually get their act together enough to be able to build and field a credible nuclear capability. Turkey maybe could, but I think that if they just decided to do that, that might be the straw that breaks the camel's back for NATO, and NATO would expunge them from the alliance. People at NATO are pretty darn cranky with Turkey and a lot of their behaviors under Erdogan over the last few years. And I think that if they decided to get nuclear weapons in response, that may really start to turn the tide against Turkey and NATO. The prospect of an Arab bomb, I'm dismissive of it. I think a lot of people raise it as a possibility, but I just think that a lot of the inhibitions for why none of the states that have had nuclear Why none of the Arab states have pursued nuclear weapons up to this point, other than a very brief 6-year period in Egypt in the 1960s and 1970s. No Arab state has pursued nuclear weapons seriously. And I think that the reasons why they haven't would still be in place, even if Iran became a nuclear power.
Yeah. So as we think through, you know, how does this end? You know, it seems the Israeli perspective of, on this is the way that this ends is the total and complete destruction of Hamas, the total and complete destruction of Hezbollah if possible. You know, they're moving into Lebanon, and southern Lebanon is historically Hezbollah's sort of stomping ground. And, you know, the challenge with Hezbollah is that you don't necessarily have had this been 20 years ago or 30 years ago, you might have had a Lebanese government that would sort of help with that. But Hezbollah is so entrenched now that, you know, there's no Lebanese government that's going to help, you know, with the elimination. So that's a harder sell. But, you know, Gaza and the West Bank, you can probably eliminate Hamas. And then you've got the problem of Iran. And so do you decapitate Iran? Do you take down their nuclear, you know, capability? And then how does it end? Because Israel is sort of willing to step into a world in which everybody's mad at them, at least, you know, publicly. Much of the Arab world is sort of, they hold their fire, you know, they're not too critical, but they're sort of careful about their own domestic populations and how they feel. And so they're sort of balancing that. But 6 months, a year from now, does this end? How does it end?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you're right. I mean, I think you've laid out the goals correctly for Israel when it comes to Hamas and Hezbollah. Like I said earlier, that's the real question is in Israel is what do we do about Iran? Those are the guys calling the shots. And what do we do? And because I think that, you know, what both parties have discovered is that there is no modus vivendi for both Israel and Iran. Like, these are two states that after the past 12 months, there's no way for them to just live in peace and have a normalized relationship with one another. One of these states has to fall. I actually think that's where we are, is one of these states have to fall. And I know if I had to choose which one of those states would fall, where I would be putting all my money on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're probably right in terms of, you know, amongst the Arab nations, they'd probably rather have Israel than Iran. They understand the challenges that Iran poses and sort of Israel's desire to just get along and live in peace. And so there's, you know, with the exception of perhaps, you know, Syria and, you know, the a heavily Hezbollah-influenced Lebanese government. I mean, it's interesting that the Egyptians have been unwilling, you know, to open the Rafah gate and allow, you know, the Palestinians, because this is sort of, you know, the challenge is, you know, as I think about this idea of, you know, many people don't really understand that this concept of Palestinian versus Israeli is only a creation that began in the 1970s, right? That term wasn't, they considered themselves Arabs. They didn't consider themselves Palestinians. It's a term that was created by Yasser Arafat to try to sort of unify largely the Muslim population as opposed to the Jewish population.
Right. And it was myth building on the part of Arafat on how do you create this kind of creation myth for the people of this, of all the Muslims who lived in this land.
Yeah. And there was this concept of, you know, that people have said, hey, listen, there is a Palestinian state. It's called Jordan. You know, Jordan is the Palestinian state, but, you know, Yasser Arafat and others couldn't have the same level of power if they had to, you know, start, you know, supporting the king of Jordan and you know, the Hashemite kingdom of in Jordan. So therefore they're like, hey, we want our own, we want to maintain our own power. And so therefore you've had this sort of conflict that won't go away in the West Bank and Gaza. And I wonder, just as if you were to get rid of Hamas, as, you know, sort of the Israelis are doing, does that solve the problem, particularly in Gaza, or do we still have, does that sort of, you know, reappear in a different form and fashion? It's, you know, it's such a challenging, you know, it's such a challenging problem that, and particularly for we Americans who sort of are happy with the status quo, you know, how do we think through it and how do we see the solution? And I'm not sure we really can do that effectively.
Yeah. I think I agree with every word of that.
Okay. So now that we're sort of talked out, I'm going to bring out Bob the Genie. Of course, Bob the Genie, no relation, because you're a mere mortal. So you can't be related to the genie, but as Bob the Genie grants you your three wishes, Bob Peters,
What's wish
number one?
First wish is for the hostages to come home. First and foremost, the 7 Americans that are still being held hostage. And then everyone else to go home and be reunited with their families and get out of the living hell in which they find themselves. That's my first wish.
Yeah, that's a good wish.
Second wish is for the people of Israel to be able to get the munitions they need to defend their nation. And so they need missile interceptors and they need the things that they need in order to stop the salvo of missiles that are raining terror on almost a daily basis on Israel. And so, you know, people who are in preschool and, you know, Adam, you know, our kids are about the same age. There's middle schoolers, I'm sure, that are going and doing shelter in place drills in Israel. And, you know, whether they're buying interceptors from Europeans or building new production facilities, either in Israel or overseas, they need it. What's clear to me is they need a sustained pipeline of munitions to be able to ensure their security. And that's going to be a real multi-year problem. That's my second wish is for the people of Israel. My third wish is for the people of Palestine, the Palestinians themselves. And look, I'm an American. And at one point, my ancestors came over on some boats and they settled in Virginia Colony and they settled in Massachusetts Bay Colony because they realized that life sucked in England. And even though that they were Englishmen, they needed to go to a new land and build a new life for their families. And if I were a Palestinian and I were living in one of these camps in the West Bank or in Gaza or wherever, because my great grandfather 75 years ago or 80 years ago lost his house. And for three or now four generations, we've been living in some camp, waiting for the day in which our ancestral land had been returned to us that I'd never seen before. My parents never seen before. I'd be pissed. I would be pissed that like great grandpa Peters didn't say, okay, guys, we're getting out of here. We're going to Canada or Argentina or Australia. I don't care, but someplace is better than here. And, you know, maybe he was a really prosperous great grandpa Peter, which was a really prosperous farmer or whatever 80 years ago, but I don't care because that doesn't change the fact of the matter that as an adult, I need to do what's right for my wife and my children and my family and ensure that they've got prosperity. Cause at the end of the day, I love my kids who are alive far more than I care about great grandpa Peters, who's been dead for 35, 40 years. And I value my family way more than some land that I may or may not have had at some point X number of years ago. And doing right by my family is sure more important than me living in some, as a refugee in some UN administered camp in some UN administered school. I'm getting the hell out of there. And I'm going to go, like I said, I'm going to go to Argentina and open a barbecue joint, or I'm going to go become a welder in Newfoundland.
You pick a country.
Yeah. Right. And it doesn't matter like what the job is. I'll push a broom in a middle school in Germany and try, if that's what it requires, to give a better life for my family. And so that's my hope for the people of Palestine, is the Palestinian people, that they value the lives of their children more than they value the memories of their grandparents.
Yeah, that's well put. And that's the challenge of an honor shame culture, is that, you're stuck, with this legacy and, trying to essentially avenge that loss. And so, they've had to live with that for, 75 years, 80 years now. All right. Well, Bob, thanks for joining me again. It's an interesting discussion. It's a long held problem that has, 80 years yet to be solved. In some respects, it's somewhat like the Korean Peninsula, where, it's one of these challenges that just doesn't want to be solved. And, there's reasons why people don't want it solved. So thanks for joining me. Of course, thanks for you, the listeners. Hopefully you found this episode thought-provoking as we, remember the October 7th anniversary and sort of where this year has been. And, in a few months when we hit the third anniversary in February, it's the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We'll look back on 3 years now and we'll sort of see where we are. So Bob, thanks. It's good to see you. Thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, October 7th, it's, very clearly a somber day as we look a year into this, war in Israel. And, it's a country, if you remember, it's a country that's essentially the size of New Jersey, and it's fighting on essentially every front. And so it's one where, for both sides, it's a challenging thing. And so as we think through it, it was great to have Bob on to discuss it. And, for you, the listeners, you got to make your own decisions about how you see it. But hopefully you enjoyed the discussion.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.